It's Robert Stark here, and I am back here with Luke Ford. Luke, it's nice having you on for just one more show. I guess you're now an officially regular.
Hey, Robert, good to talk to you.
So what we're going to be discussing is the topic and theme of narcissism and the different variants of narcissism. And we've discussed this before in previous shows. So you've been diagnosed personally with a narcissistic personality disorder.
Correct. In year 2000, my family offered me a free trip home to Australia if I would see doctors of their choice. And they weren't happy with the course that my life was on. I was making my living from blogging about the pornography industry. And one of the doctors that I went to see was a psychiatrist who, with my permission, reported back to my family that applying the DSM-4, Luke has a personality disorder of the histrionic narcissistic type. Luke is very dependent upon other people for his identity as a person. He has poor identity integration and poor self-esteem. Luke is always looking for mirroring. That's called narcissistic supply. Luke is always looking for external validation of himself as a person. He needs other people to tell him who he is. However, because it is not possible for people to mirror him all the time, he gets disappointed, and this can turn to envy. Luke may not be conscious of the fact that he is very envious of his family. They seem to have things he would like to have but does not have. This leads him to fluctuating between, on the one hand, devaluing people such as the family, putting them down. On the other hand, idealizing people such as Dennis Prager. Luke tends to make unreasonable demands of people who are eventually driven to set limits on him. Luke takes this very badly. Luke needs 5 to 10 years of insight-oriented psychotherapy. It was the falling out with Dennis Prager that caused him to go to therapy. While Luke has a lot of therapy speak, he may not really understand the concepts involved. Luke's therapist did well to keep him in therapy for 15 months. That is unusual for someone with Luke's condition, as such people often leave off therapy when it becomes too confronting. Luke will continue to do what he is doing to satisfy his needs until such times as the rewards are outweighed by the negative effects. Then he may do something about getting his life on track and getting therapy or going back to finish his university degree. The negative effects of his current behavior are that no one will have a long-term relationship with him. People cannot live without getting something back, and Luke is always taking without giving anything back. Second, any decent woman who looked at his website would be immediately repulsed. Luke has a very complicated personality. He has mood instability. He becomes very focused on one thing. Then when he is not getting the desired rewards, he drops it and moves on. So that's the psychiatric report on me from year 2000.
Would you say it's accurate?
Yeah. I'd say that's pretty accurate. So whether it's, say, 60% accurate or 98% accurate, it's somewhere in that ballpark.
I think one of the biggest misconceptions about narcissist and narcissism is that narcissists constantly have high self-esteem. What happens is they fluctuate back and forth. So a narcissist may... And you're not just talking about, you're talking about narcissism in general or specifically narcissistic personality disorder, but they fluctuate back and forth, so they, for a while, they may have low self-esteem and then they go back and forth.
Yeah, like fundamentally what's down deep is narcissism comes from childhood abuse, and the reality was so painful that to survive the reality of early childhood, they had to imagine that you know, that there was someone amazing, and that other people simply didn't see how amazing they are. And so while that's kind of an adaptive trick, you know, when you're a kid, it's, you know, you kind of check out by fantasizing about how wonderful you are. As you go along, it becomes maladaptive. So for me, it definitely became maladaptive. Like, I grew up in foster care, and I was just reading this interview with a professor of neuroscience, and you made the point that a child is born into a situation where touch is deprived, you know, then that child will develop terrible psychiatric problems, attachment disorders, mood disorders, and also physical problems, problems with the digestive system and the immune system, higher incidence of diabetes. Well, that 100% applies to me. So it's from this background in unstable attachment. So it's like it's not secure attachment, which most of the population has, but this is insecure attachment or anxious attachment, where you're always looking for reassurance, and so you're very emotionally needy, and you become a drain on people, and so you become unpopular, and this makes you even more needy, and it's a bad cycle to get into. And so when everyone around you starts rejecting you, you really get into the fantasy that you're just an amazing person and they simply can't see it. And then the more you get stuck into fantasy and the more addicted you get to fantasizing as a drug to get you away from your misery, then, you know, the brain is plastic. So you program the brain, you know, to check out into these fantasies. So another way of describing it is maladaptive daydreaming, where you just kind of go through your day fantasizing, you know, what if I had $1 million, or what if I was the editor of the Los Angeles Times, or what if I was the president of the United States? That's, you know, something that I've suffered from all my life.
What were your biggest sort of fantasies that you've had, and fantasies of how you'd picture yourself?
Always with power. Like all my sexual fantasies and my fantasies in general are always that I'm a very powerful person. So, you know, even though it's impossible, I often had the fantasy as a child that I'd one day be president of the United States. To much lesser degree, I've had fantasies that one day I'll be prime minister of Australia. I've also had fantasies that I'll be the editor of the Jewish Journal of Los Angeles, or I'll be the editor of the Los Angeles Times, or the editor of the New York Times, and then how things would change. And I often like fantasize, okay, what I would do, how I would assign reporters, and how I'd change things if I was the editor. And so probably the most common fantasy I've had over the last few years is like, what if someone gave me $5 million to start up an online newspaper, and who are the people that I would hire, and what would be the stories that I'd assign? So I can very easily, you know, spend hours a day daydreaming. So it's not a good thing for a 48-year-old man such as myself to spend so much time daydreaming.
Well, I don't have narcissistic personality disorder that I'm aware of, but a lot of that would describe myself as well.
Yeah, well, most people who do, most or close to most of the people who do what we do have problems with narcissism. Like, what kind of person spends, you know, so much of their spare time blogging or, you know, podcasting or something like that? It's usually people who are really needy for attention, adulation, and influence, or some like some form of power. And so people with this personality type are the types who spend an inordinate amount of time blogging, podcasting, or going into, say, politics or going into the media. These are fields that particularly appeal to narcissists, because what we're looking for is we're looking for constant narcissistic supply. That means other people giving us attention and telling us who we are and kind of modulating us, because without other people constantly giving us that attention, we feel lost and we very quickly spin into depression and kind of start falling apart. But if we can get that constant stream of narcissistic supply, then we feel on top of the world. And so by blogging and by podcasting, we get feedback if we do it well. And so that feedback tells us that we're okay and that we're making a contribution and that we're worthwhile human beings. While from perhaps an objective point of view, people who know us best, you know, may to our face or behind our back, you know, refer to us as losers. Certainly, most people in my religious community who know me very much regard me as a loser. I'm 48 years old. I have $45,000 in credit card debt. I have no assets. I've never been married. I have no children. I have no prospects of being married. And by all objective perspectives, a person with these qualities is a loser. And how do I spend my spare time? I spend my spare time blogging. So that does sound like the quintessential narcissist.
Have you ever, and have you been socially ostracized because of your blogging at times?
Oh, certainly. I've been socially ostracized. I've been socially ostracized throughout my life, so my blogging is just a reflection of my social maladaption, the way that I don't get along very easily with other people. So I managed to have a handful of friends in grade school, but very rarely did I bump up above like the mid-level of social status. So usually I wasn't at the very bottom either, but I was kind of like around the middle, but with not many friends. And so my life has been a pretty lonely one. And again, this is another typical characteristic of the narcissist or the person with simply insecure or anxious attachment style. And this is the type of person who often blogs or podcasts.
How does it affect the subject matter and things you talk about in your blog?
Well, what the narcissist most wants is narcissistic supply, which is another fancy term for attention. So, a narcissist will be looking for attention-getting stories and for placing himself at the center of the story and will be perhaps attracted to dangerous stories and dangerous people and kind of living on the edge because that provides him with the most feeling of excitement. So not all junkies are narcissists, but all narcissists are adrenaline junkies. And when we get our narcissistic supply, when we get our constant stream of attention, we feel elated, omnipotent, omniscient, handsome, sexy, adventurous, invisible, irresistible. But when that narcissistic supply goes missing, we first enter a manic phase of trying to replenish that supply, and then if we get no supply, we just kind of shrivel up, we deflate, we withdraw from the world, we become depressed. And I'm quoting Sam Vaknin, Vaknin, who's done a lot of excellent work on the area of narcissism. It's something that he suffers from.
So, you must have gotten a pretty big rush when you appeared on 60 Minutes.
Yeah, I got a rush on 60 Minutes, and I got a rush when I was on Entertainment Tonight. I got a rush when I was on the cover of the Jewish Journal of Los Angeles. But I remember on that Sabbath, no one invited me home for a meal. So, some people said, interesting story, but it certainly didn't raise my social status. It didn't fill any hole in me. I didn't like meet anyone from it. I didn't gain any friends from it. I didn't get any Sabbath meal invites or Jewish holiday meal invites. I wasn't like included anymore because of it. So, yeah, at times when I've appeared on television, it's helped me to say meet more people. It's drawn more readers to my blog. So yeah, it has some effect. It makes you feel like, okay, I'm alive. I'm on TV.
I noticed if you Google your name after your website, one of the interviews we did is the first thing that shows up after Wikipedia and your website. And I think there's an Australian actor with the same name.
Yeah, there's an Australian actor with my name who's done some movies and done some mainly Australian television and Australian movies. Luke Ford, yeah.
What a topic's subject matter has gotten you socially ostracized the most?
I'd say writing on the pornography industry, far and away, that was the most socially ostracizing thing that I've ever written about. It's just kind of it's a dirty, disgusting industry that people may have an interest in, but they don't want such people in their life. So, people may use drugs, but they don't invite their drug dealer home to meet their family. People may use prostitutes or may sleep with, very skanky hoes, but they don't want to introduce such women to their family and friends. And the same goes for someone who writes about the pornography industry.
And your current subject matter, that has gotten, would you say that's gotten you more ostracized, more so or less, the stuff you're writing about now?
Oh, it hasn't had nearly the ostracizing effect that writing on the pornography industry has. So I write a lot about race, and I certainly ruffled some feathers and had some acquaintances turn against me and cut me out of their life, but they were so insignificant to me, I couldn't even tell you their names if you pushed me. So far there hasn't been a big backlash. But that could happen at any time. These things aren't fully, totally predictable.
And you change, how does it, and also how does it, it affects your subject matter? Like how, for example, how did narcissism affect your current subject matter versus writing about the porn industry?
Well, it's hard to really be clear on that, because I'm a narcissist, and so I'm trying to look outside of myself objectively, and it's not easy. So certainly I got a lot of attention for writing on controversial topics, and for writing on dangerous topics, and for hanging out with dangerous people and writing dangerous things. So that is very characteristic of the narcissist. A lot of narcissists are attracted to things like investigative journalism, or writing or doing things that are controversial or edgy. So something else that's important here is that I've been in therapy basically since the year 2000. So that can have a profound effect on you. I've been in 12-step work for over 3 years now. That can really shape and change your character. So I'm more cognizant now when I'm in a narcissistic state, and I know how to get out of it better by doing some meditation, or through just being quiet for a while until the kind of the manic mania of narcissism kind of fades. I know that there's one synagogue that I go to regularly where I've kind of set a limit on myself. I will not ask any questions publicly, because I know I have a personality tendency that wants to kind of show off how smart I am. And so I completely throttle that down at this one particular synagogue to make sure I cause no waves. I never ask the rabbi any questions publicly. If I have a question, I'll ask someone about it privately. But I never want to be the center of attention at this one particular synagogue that I go to. So there are things that you can do as you age and become wiser. Narcissism, like some other personality defects, usually tends to become less strong as you age. As you get older, it starts to release its grip somewhat, and I think I've made a lot of progress over the years.
At what point in your life did it have the strongest effect on your psyche and how you interacted with people?
That's hard to say. Probably what would be easier to say is when did it have the least effect? And that I can pinpoint. And that's whenever I felt really connected to other people. And there have been times in my life where I felt strongly connected to other people. And then that narcissistic side of me is kind of quieted. And I remember there was this one family that I stayed with during summer times during high school. And I was just embraced as part of the family, and my narcissistic side and my whole attention getting side just kind of quietened down, and I felt normal. So when I'm able to connect with other people, my whole system kind of quietens down. I become a much more calm person. And when I'm not able to connect with other people, I become increasingly weird, almost manic, trying to get attention. So the times when I've been able to be a part of a synagogue community, or be a part of a religious community, or be a part of a family, or to have a good circle of friends or a good social circle. That's when I've behaved the most normally. My narcissism's been the most under control. I was able to read social cues better. I was just calmer inside. It's like my whole system calms down when I'm able to connect to some people.
And people can, yeah, they can pick up on those cues when those emotions are the strongest.
Well, yeah, like if you're feeling calm and secure inside, that radiates out. And so your form of attachment can change. Like in our first few years, most people are securely attached, or some people are develop what's called insecure or anxious attachment, or other people avoidant attachment. And that attachment style can change. For instance, someone who's securely attached through dating someone who's insecure or avoidant, that can drive them nuts so that they lose their secure attachment and they just lose their head. Like, love can do that to you. On the other hand, an insecure person can date a secure, which has happened for me, and then my whole system like calms down and I become normal, and many of my impulses become normal. And that also applies to just having like a good, strong group of friends or a good social circle. In Australia, which is much more homogeneous, say, white society than the United States, there's much more of a feeling of mateship and camaraderie with your fellows. And so you feel more of an easy bond with the people around you. And so there's much less apparent narcissism. Like America seems much more narcissistic because America is much more diverse. So people don't have as easy a time bonding with those around them, because the people around them are of different races, different religions. And
what
so,
happens,
yeah, is, people are much more isolated in America.
If you don't have an identity with a group, then you're forced to, you're basically forced to develop your identity completely as an individual.
Yeah, and no one can develop their identity as an individual. Basically, you have to develop it within a group. And so people are much less likely to have solid communal life in the United States than in Australia, because the United States now is so multiracial and multicultural. And so this huge attention seeking that you see in America today is a symptom of this dislocated society we have, because for the anxiously attached person now, our huge attention seeking is our substitute for normal love and normal human connection. And when you don't get that normal human connection, then you're much more likely to start doing bizarre things just to try to get attention, because attention makes you feel alive. And if you're not connected to other people, you don't really feel alive. You feel much more disposable.
And it definitely affects people, like people who get into blogging or join. People who get into blogging, they're people who lack that in real life, and they get a status through their blogging. Or people who get involved in fringe, we've discussed this before, but people who get involved in fringe politics, they're people who've basically, a lot of them, they basically failed at conventional, at life in conventional society, so they have to go to the margins and find a place where they can have a, where they can play a role or have, or where they feel valued.
Yeah, like for instance, when I go to synagogue, I see a lot of people that I admire. Now, I see people who are doctors and lawyers, they're married and they have multiple children. So, you know, they're kicking it. They're really living life is meant to be lived. On the other hand, in like the white nationalist movement, there aren't that many people who one admires on a human-to-human level. There aren't that many people married with children holding down responsible jobs. You know, there aren't a lot of doctors and lawyers and university professors in our movement. You have a lot of people who aren't married, never been married, no kids, just people who you just don't particularly admire, even if you share their political, social, cultural views. So, you know, the white nationalist movement does not tend to attract people who have things to lose. Like if you have a wife and kids, if you have a prestigious position in your community, in your profession, if you're a doctor, lawyer, or university professor, you're unlikely to risk everything that you have to be a white nationalist. On the other hand, if you've got nothing, then you can feel much more free to say what you believe and to pursue your beliefs, even if they're unpopular. So I'm not saying that all white nationalists are nuts by any means, but we do attract a disproportionate number of people with severe personality disorders, and we do attract a lot of people who are, you know, deeply unhappy and have failed at life.
And how you touched on this earlier, but how does it affect, you're saying your sexual fantasies have primarily been about the theme of power, and I think you talked about this in your one-man play.
Yeah, I talked about this in my one-man play, Eroticized Rage, but you know, usually in our sexual fantasies, we're trying to fulfill something that's lacking in our real life. So, for instance, I remember when I dated this woman who was a powerful woman, she wanted to be totally dominated in the bedroom, but nowhere else. You know, aside from that, she was in charge. She was a very tough, strong lady, but in the bedroom, she wanted to be totally dominated. Well, for me, it was the opposite. In so much of real life, I feel powerless. So that therefore, in the bedroom, being in control, being powerful is much more important to me. And so also through sex, we try to kind of act out our you know, deepest wounds from childhood. We all have a love map, a map of what we find erotic. And this reflects our earliest experiences, because for most people, first time we fall in love is with our opposite sex parent. And so that experience when we're 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years of age will often shape our sexuality for the rest of their life, for the rest of our lives. But it doesn't have to be a disabling illness. You know, you can get help. And I think of it, out of everything I've done, probably 12-step work has really helped the most. So I've been able to change my life from where I was probably fantasizing about sex for, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours a day. You know, these days it's probably less than 15 minutes most days. You know,
that's just, also probably because you're getting older.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be, it's not, not for 3 hours to 15 minutes. That doesn't change like that moving from age 45 to 48. Like the sex drive maybe goes down by about 3% in those years. It doesn't go down by, you know, 1,000%. So yeah, getting older will slightly decrease your sex drive, but not that much. But you can do things so that instead of spending hours a day fantasizing, you can come back to reality and just start thinking about, oh, what can I do, you know, in my real life to improve things. And You can do meditation, you can do 12-step work, and you can do therapy to come back, get much more rooted in reality, and to be able to be much more objective about yourself, and to become much more aware when, you know, you're in the grip of some narcissistic attention-seeking mania.
And has Alexander Technique helped with that?
Yeah, it's also helped me profoundly. Everyone who's close to me has noticed that I'm much easier to deal with since I took up the Alexander Technique. You learn to have much greater constructive control of yourself. You learn to inhibit your habitual reactions that don't serve you. So you can be much more calm and you can have much more awareness of, oh, you know, I notice how I constantly react in a certain way. And it doesn't serve me. Let me simply abstain from reacting to this stimuli. And whether it's, you know, someone yelling at you, or you're simply in a room and no one's paying attention to you, whatever the stimulus is, you gain increasing control over how you react to that stimulus, and you have much more inner peace, inner calm, and then that affects the way that you relate to other people, which becomes a cycle. So if you relate to other people in a calm way, they're much more likely to relate to you in a calm way. And so you stay out of much more needless confrontation, and you stay out of a lot of self-destructive behaviors. You know, you're more likely to drive carefully and to conduct yourself in a constructive way throughout your life.
Would you say the narcissistic personality disorder, would you say it's on the neurotic spectrum?
I don't really know what is neurotic and what is not neurotic. I just know that narcissistic personality disorder is really a symptom of insecure attachment. And so the two ways to primarily deal with that have been effective for large numbers of people is, one, to get people connected to God, to the transcendent, and two, to get people connected to others, particularly those who suffer from the same addictions and personality disorders. Because when you hear someone else, you know, give over a story similar to yours, and you see how they've able to improve their lives, it creates room for bonding with them, and it's this connection to other people that calms down the attachment system that each one of us has, so that we become much more secure rather than reactive or avoidant.
And those with narcissistic personality disorder, you also say they often confuse sex and love, and attention becomes a substitute for intimacy.
Yeah, I remember seeing that with the porn stars. You know, the dominant trait was that they weren't connected strongly to either a religion, an ethnic group, generally, you know, speaking to a family or any kind of real community. They were alone and lonely people looking for attention. And attention is the cheap, easy way that needy people substitute for love. For people who are unable to love and be loved in a normal, healthy way, attention seeking is how they substitute and try to fill that hole in their soul.
And you have these posts by Sam Vaknin, and he wrote a book about narcissism. But can you give some sort of a background information about who Sam Vaknin is?
Well, he's an Israeli, and he has an enormous presence on YouTube and on the web. He was born in 1961. And at three different times in his life, he got diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder after he'd hit rock bottom. And the first two times, he just dismissed it. But the third time, after he got arrested and he was put away for financial fraud, you know, as a condition of his parole, he had to agree to a mental health evaluation. And he had this dominant evaluation of narcissistic personality disorder. And finally, 1996, he accepted the diagnosis, and he made it kind of the focus of his life. And from 1997 on, he was writing about narcissistic personality, studying narcissistic personality, and corresponding with people, mainly people who've suffered from having narcissists in their life.
Have you corresponded with him?
No, I've just read his work, and I enjoy listening to him on YouTube. It's interesting, one of the traits of the narcissist, which I've certainly suffered from, is idol worship. You know, we tend to put people that we admire on pedestals, because if we find someone who's perfect that we can get close to, you know, maybe some of their perfection will rub off on me and I'll become perfect by association. And then,
I've
done
that myself. If I'm feeling, there's been times in my life where I was feeling anxious or insecure, so I would imagine that I was this other person.
Yeah, well, that's called creating a false self. Almost all narcissists, we create a false self that we hope that other people will admire, because, you know, we don't really like who we are. And so either we'll worship someone else, or we'll create this false self But these are all things that we're doing to try to get away from who we really are.
So, in your life, Dennis Prager has been the main. You've have sort of had a lifelong admiration, some could say obsession, with Dennis Prager.
Yeah, Dennis Prager has probably played more of a role in my life than any other thinker, at least for a few years. These days I don't find him particularly interesting. I gave up listening to his show about 5 months ago. For the first time in 30 years, I'm not listening to his radio show anymore. And occasionally do I read his articles online. But I have had a lifelong habit of idolizing certain people, usually intellectuals. It takes an intellectual to command my ongoing attention and constant, following, wanting to follow what they have to say. So that's been a lifelong trait. So Dennis Prager has been one, probably the most influential, or at least for a time, he was the most influential of all the people that I've put on a pedestal. But I notice I still do have this tendency to put people on a pedestal while devaluing other people. But I have much more of an awareness of this tendency, and I have much less of a need to do it than I've needed to do it in the past. Like when I was basically bedridden for 6 years in my 20s, that was a very desperate time. I was getting no narcissistic supply because I was bedridden. I wasn't accomplishing anything. And I really had a strong need during that time for a hero, someone to, idolize. And Dennis Prager played that role for me in my 20s.
And you said you felt rejected by him. Did you say you felt that way, or he officially rejected you?
As I mentioned, it was during my 20s when I was bedridden that he really played the heroic role for me. And then as I got into my 30s, I was past that and I just wanted to write about some of the things that he was talking about on his radio show. So I knew that as soon as I started writing about his radio show and disagreeing with him, that he would end all personal contact with me, which basically is what happened. So since 1997, virtually all the friends that I had in common with Dennis Prager and Dennis Prager have pretty much cut off personal contact with me. I knew that would happen before I started writing. It didn't make it any less painful when I went through that rejection, but it was just kind of part of my growing up and becoming more independent in my worldview. So it was a phase, and some of the people that I've gotten back onto speaking terms with, I have no idea what Dennis Prager thinks about me. I don't really think about that anymore. There was a time in 1998 when my therapist pointed out to me that Dennis Prager had such a big impact on my life that I had a desire to have an impact on his life. And I thought about that. I go, oh, wow, there's something to that. And from that moment on, I never felt any need to talk about Dennis Prager in my therapy. So that was in 1998.
Is he so is he even aware that you exist?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely where I exist. I have a large body of work on him. I have a about a 200-page online unauthorized biography of him. So, if we saw each other, we would certainly be cordial and friendly and hi, how are you? But as far as someone who I think about, as opposed to just thinking about his ideas, that pretty much ended in 1998 when my therapist gave me that realization that because Dennis Prager had such a huge impact on me, that I then wanted to do something with that. And that's what was a psychological motivation for my blogging about him. And I go, oh yeah, that's right. And as soon as I had that realization, all that psychological motivation just kind of disappeared. So I was able to just purely blog from the perspective of what I found interesting or not interesting in what he said. And I was able to leave behind that period of time in my 20s when I was so desperate for a hero because my own life had fallen apart.
And do you play that role that Dennis Prager played for you for other individuals?
Yeah, I think we all have people who look up to us. And I know I definitely have people who look up to me and admire me and seek out my counsel. So that's just how the world works. We all are a hero to somebody usually.
So you have this other post. It's another Sam Vaknin video, and it's called The Narcissist and His Addiction to Excitement. So this applies to the adrenaline rush that you might get from getting attention, but it can apply to other addictions like sexual addictions or drug addictions, or people who are like thrill seekers who do things that are dangerous.
Right. So if you're doing things that are dangerous, but not for the attention that you get, but simply for the thrill, then you're unlikely to be a narcissist. You're probably just an adrenaline junkie. But if you're doing things to get attention, that's the primary motivating fire underneath what you do. And that's how it is for narcissists. Then, you know, that's a symptom of narcissistic personality disorder. Now, I will tell you, incidentally, that none of my therapists have regarded me as having narcissistic personality disorder. But they all agreed with me that I had some tendencies in that direction. So I did receive that diagnosis from one psychiatrist who spent 3 hours with me in the year 2000. But none of the therapists that I've seen every week since the year 2000 agreed with that diagnosis. But they did see some tendencies in that direction. So, for instance, I've never been tempted to do anything illegal. You know, I've never been arrested in my life. I've never, broken those kind of boundaries that, many narcissists feel driven to do.
What's prevented you from breaking the law?
Fear just wasn't the way I was raised. I've always had some empathy for other people, so I didn't want to hurt them. It wasn't even a struggle. It wasn't like, oh, I'm dying to break the law. That's just not who I am. I'm a, very law abiding, always have been. I couldn't face myself in the mirror if I, ripped somebody off or did something horrible to somebody. So, my narcissistic tendencies have always been tempered by these other personality tendencies that I have, to be very law abiding and to want to always regard myself as an upstanding, righteous person.
Would you say this is a case for often people who do go on to kill people, like, say, serial killers and mass shooters?
Yeah, I think some serial killers are narcissists. I'm not sure most of them are. I think that's would probably be an accurate diagnosis for some of them. But I don't think people should get scared that just because somebody in their life has narcissistic personality tendencies or even has narcissistic personality disorder that they are any kind of violent threat. It'd be very, very, very rare narcissist who would be any kind of violent threat.
Yeah, I mean, it's so prevalent.
I'm sure, at least 20, I guess maybe 20% of the population has some problems with narcissism. I'm just equating with the percentage of the population that has insecure attachment or anxious attachment style. So, about 20% of the population probably has some problems with narcissism, but very few of those would be lawbreakers, let alone violent.
But I guess people who are violent, because let's say someone does a mass murderer, they get a lot of attention in the media, and there's individuals who they feel like they're nothing at the time, so they just crave that attention at any means necessary.
Yeah, and if you're dealing with a high IQ person who's committing murder because they want to be famous, then what you're saying would apply, but very few murderers have high IQs. And of those high IQ murderers, they're not usually doing it for attention. So, most murderers have very low IQs. Like the average IQ of people in prison is something like 85, which is the average IQ for blacks in America. So I don't think narcissistic personality disorder is a primary driving force behind murder in America. I think it's an incidental facet for some.
But I'm talking about like your typical violent thug in prison. I'm talking about like these fam like famous serial killers.
Yeah, I'm sure some of them have narcissistic personality disorder, but I'm sure a lot more of them have sociopathy, where they just have an antisocial personality tendency. I would expect that would be much higher than the rate for narcissism. But I'm sure other people have done more work on this than I have. I never really thought of that much about serial killers and narcissism.
And this was a kind of a post. This post was a joke, but I remember a while back you had this post where you were joking that you listed characteristics of a serial killer, and you were like, "Oh, am I a serial killer?"
Oh yeah, I think I remember that. Yeah, so I had Kendra Jade, who was a porn star who I was close to for a while many years ago, and she loved to read books on serial killers, so she'd often tell me how I have all the characteristics of the serial killer.
Didn't oh the Zodiac I think the Zodiac killer didn't wasn't he his murder this was like long before you were there. I think his murders took place around the college you went to, the Seventh
Yeah,
Adventist.
yeah, they did take place around then, and or near where I lived at the time. So that was a very powerful movie. I remember that. It was Kendra Jade. She just would say she had a thing for reading books on serial killers. So, okay, this was a blog post because when I first took an acting class, when I moved to LA, June 1994, every role I played, I always played it like a serial killer. Now, it just came across as crazy intense and kind of frightening, and had this kind of weird stare. And so the whole class just would always crack up because no matter what I was doing, I always played it like a serial killer. So the headline is, "I grew up with all the signs of becoming a serial killer." And it was a blog post, "According to Dr. Phil, signs of a future serial killer, I pretty much have them all." And then I mentioned how Kendra Jade was the first person to point this out to me. She had this great fascination with serial killers. So, okay, characteristic number one, over 90% of serial killers are male. Check. They tend to be intelligent with IQs in the bright normal range. Check. They do poorly in school, have trouble holding down jobs, and often work as unskilled laborers. Check. They come from markedly unstable families. Check. As children, they are abandoned by their fathers and raised by domineering mothers. Check. Their families often have criminal, psychiatric, and alcoholic histories. Check. They are commonly abused as children. Check. Many serial killers spend time in institutions or in foster care. Check. They have high rates of suicide attempts. No check. I've never tried that. From an early age, many are intensely interested in voyeurism, fetishism, and sadomasochistic pornography. Check. More than 60% of serial killers wet their beds beyond the age of 12. I think I stopped that before the age of 5. Many serial killers are fascinated with fire starting. When I was a kid, I was fascinated by starting fires. They are involved with sadistic activity or tormenting small creatures. Yeah, as a kid, I don't know, I would mess around with ants. I tried to start an ant hospital, but I guess that was weird. So yeah, those are some of the characteristics.
So you have this post, and it's fairly recent. It's called Love at First Sight, and you have this picture You say, all the loves of my life have looked like this. And
Yeah. I know what you're talking about. So I heard out of the blue from someone that you know I'd had a thing for, and it took me back to the time that I met her. It was at a party, and just as soon as I saw her, I was just attracted by her smile and who she was. And it wasn't primarily a lust thing. I want to sleep with her. This was, I just want to be around this woman. And I got to know her over the months that followed. And while she never showed any IOIs, no signs of indicators of interest in going out with me, you know, I got to know her a little bit. So whenever I see her picture or something that reminds me of her, my heart skips a beat, and you know, I become sometimes emotionally flooded. So, you know, yeah, can there be such a thing as love at first sight? I think particularly guys are susceptible to this. That there's like an archetype that we respond to, and so pretty much all the women that I've fallen in love with over my life. You know, probably the biggest, say, half dozen loves of my life, they've all kind of had the same brunette, shy, good girl type of look.
And is that her, or that's just a picture of a model that looks like her?
That's just a picture of a model that vaguely looks like her. You know, I'd never put, I share a lot on my blog, but I would never share a picture of someone that, someone that I was obsessed with on my blog, or someone who had such a deep emotional effect on me. Just, you know, thinking about her would shake me up. I've never put any identifying details about such a woman on my blog. But yeah, you know, I have an archetype, and I think most guys do. We all have a love map. You know, it's a developmental representation, or it's like a template in the mind and the brain depicting the idealized lover. And it was developed by John Money, who was a psychiatrist. But it's like having a native language, you know, it kind of bears the mark of your own unique individuality. And someone who shakes you up like that, that's telling you quite a bit about yourself, and you know, might help you to get more insight on the course of your life, your childhood, what your wounds are, and so what you're then responding for and looking for in love. Because in love, we're almost always trying to recreate our deepest wounds from childhood so that we can then try to heal them. But of course, it's a very, very painful process. We are almost are always attracted to those who will hurt us the most deeply.
So, Luke, we're out of time. Before I wrap things up, is there anything else you'd like to add to that?
No, I'm good. You've wrapped me up at a vulnerable place. Love at first sight, my romantic archetype.
So, Luke, thanks for being on. Check out lukeford.net.
Yeah, thanks.
That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.